Coming up today, we go hands-on with the new iPads, including the new iPad Air and the Retina Display iPad Mini. Plus, our other hands go entirely on the new 6-inch screen sporting Nokia Lumia phones. And as if that wasn't enough tech, NASA has reached a new record for communicating to devices out on other planets using space lasers. Hands aren't going on those. Plus, Facebook controversy, food replacement drinks getting funding, and plenty more coming up over the next half hour. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to the future of swallowing and the future of space tech. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Nicholas Tufnell.
And listen to this. That's the sound of no Liat. And now listen further to this. That's the sound of no Liv. It's just me and you, Nicholas, today.
I know.
We're rocking this joint solo.
Yeah, I think it's going to bring a whole different vibe, and I think it's going to be great. I think everyone should just relax into it.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be interesting. Yes, now, unfortunately, Liv, a little under the weather, poorly, so get well soon, Liv. We are thinking of you. And Liat's out working on a massive feature, which we'll be talking about, no doubt, in much more detail next week. So today, let's get on with the news. First up on the list of news, the Nokia Lumia announcements. Now, Nokia World was taking place out in Abu Dhabi this week, and Katie, who everyone will recognise the voice of, has been out at Abu Dhabi to test these new phones, and I thought it'd be worth us recapping.
Yeah,
you
definitely.
Say?
Yeah.
You may be surprised, we're not starting with Apple. That's coming later. We're going to divide these into two halves. Nokia now, Apple stuff in the second half of the show. But yes, Nokia has introduced its first phablets. These are Windows phone devices with 6-inch screens, which makes them about 50% larger for comparison than the iPhone 5S screen and iPhone 5 screen, as well as larger still even than the Galaxy Note 3, which I think has about 5.6 or 5.7 inch screen, bigger even than that giant HTC One Max we saw the other day, which was about the size of a horse's cheekbone.
It's too big.
It's ginormous. These are phablets. Kind of like, a lot of people hate the name phablets, but it seems to be becoming common lexicon to use them, like phones that are bigger than a phone but smaller than a tablet. So let's call them a phablet.
I don't like the name. I've got to say, no. I find it annoying.
Well, anyway, these new Lumias, the Lumia 1520, Lumia 1320, the 1520 is the top one. These are the most powerful Windows phones we've actually seen so far. They have quad core processors. Windows Phone was technically limited to dual core in the past, but there's been an update with the Windows Phone operating system. So these are quad core processors running at, I think, 2.2 or 2.3 gigahertz, so incredibly fast. Large amounts of RAM, full HD, 1080p screens. So these are Windows phones that are technically on par with, you know, some of the highest end we're seeing from Android. Only really, I think the Note 3 is higher end than this, and that's only because it has 3 gig of RAM instead of 2 that these have got. They're going to be coming out in the UK early next year, or possibly later this year. It kind of depends how that timing works out in terms of, I don't know, building the damn things, I suppose. Now, the 1520 is the flagship of the bunch. It's going to probably cost about £500 or £600 unlocked once it comes out in the UK. The 1320 is a more basic model, has lower specs, but the same physical screen size, and that will cost about half the price of its bigger brother. But both have these 6-inch screens, crucially. Now, I think these are really, really quite interesting. We've got pictures and things on the website. If you go to wired.co.uk, search Lumia 1520, you'll find all of our pictures. And Katie, as we said earlier, flew out to Abu Dhabi to test these, and I think she was pretty impressed. She said, quote, "You were whizzing around the Windows Phone interface. It felt noticeably zippier than on any other Lumia phone that preceded it." And she also made a really good point, actually, I think, about the reasons for these phones being so powerful, or certainly a benefit of these phones, is that, quote, "No doubt Nokia and Microsoft are extremely keen to take advantage of this extra oomph," love that word, "for Xbox gaming." That's a really good point, because Windows Phone, it's tied in with Xbox. Yeah. You can play games on it that, like, tie into your friends list, you earn achievement points, and, you know, with the Xbox One coming out and the focus on tablet gaming and dual screen gaming, things like that, that could be a really interesting model if we start seeing some really high-end games that tie into Xbox Live.
And I hope it's something that they do. I think the problem with Nokia has always been software. Like, the hardware is amazing, and it looks really good, and it's really powerful. I love powerful gear. I want to get my hands on it. I want to use it. But then I look at the OS, and I think, oh, for God's sake, why are you using this? And I think I looked it up. I think they only have, Windows only has 4% share in the mobile market at the moment? Which
actually,
is...
that might be globally, but in the UK, it's actually pushing almost 10.
Really?
There was a study that just specifically for the UK market, Nokia, well, Windows Phone, but broad, not just Nokia, Windows phones are about sort of 9 or 10% now the UK market. So they are getting some tension, and I do think they're a decent third contender in this race between Apple and Google. But at the same time, the App Store is still very limited. I think Microsoft's done a decent job at building out with some good titles, but it always seems to be kind of like yesterday's really good titles and the obvious choices, which is fine. But it still means if you actually really want to be downloading a lot of apps and getting the latest apps, it's always going to be the third choice as far as a developer is concerned. It tends to be iOS first, Android a little bit later or simultaneously, and then maybe Windows Phone after that. And I think that's a real shame. But possibly with the introduction of this much higher end hardware, maybe Windows Phone could become a really strong player in the gaming space, purely because it could be tied in so well with the next generation of games consoles like the Xbox. So that would be interesting. So talking a bit more than this than I intended, but there's a 1320, as I mentioned, that's got a slightly lower spec 720p screen instead of 1080. Processor isn't quite as fast and there's less memory, that sort of stuff. Then there's another new thing, though, that Nokia launched, which is its first tablet in the Lumia range, and this is called the 2520. This is a 10-inch Windows RT tablet, so that's the sort of slightly more basic version of Windows 8, 8.1 specifically, that just came out, and is likely to be the first tablet we'll see. It is actually the first tablet that we've seen from Nokia running Windows 8. So this is really quite interesting. Katie tried this out as well and said she was really impressed. The screen looks good, she says, feels good, it looks different, it's quite colourful. You know, it's not just another 10-inch black slab, and it's got the same quad-core chip and RAM and everything as the high-end 1520 tablet. So, and it could cost about maybe 400 quid, just over 400 quid. So it could be a really interesting one, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I'll keep my eye on that because, as I say, I really like the hardware, at least.
Yeah.
But didn't it turn out that they were releasing two very similar products at the same time?
Yeah, well, sort of. That's the weird thing, because Nokia's hardware mobile division was acquired by Microsoft, and the very day, and this is literally the very, very same day, Microsoft introduced its own Surface 2 that went on sale in the US. Hours later, Nokia also now owned, although I'm not sure if it's been quite signed off entirely yet by Microsoft, launches a competitor to that product. So it's really weird. And I think it's fine, but it's sort of one of these things where I don't really know how long that sort of relationship really can carry on. I think that realistically, the products either have to be radically different, which at the moment, I don't think they are for Surface RT versus this RT product. But down the line, I can't imagine they're going to keep releasing almost identical products side by side. One of the two is going to go away.
Yeah, it would be pretty silly.
So anyway, that's it. We also, Katie did an interview with Stephen Elop, Nokia's CEO, although he's actually changing official role since the Microsoft acquisition, and also with Joe Harlow, who's a senior vice president of smart devices at Nokia. And Joe actually said that to Katie's part of the interview that Nokia's quite excited about the idea of wearable tech. Smartwatches. So it could be very interesting to start thinking about, maybe Nokia smartwatches could be coming down the line.
Absolutely. I think that would be a really good idea, particularly if they don't link it in with just their own products.
Yeah, definitely. That's going to be key. Yeah. Well, anyway, all of this stuff is on the website. Katie's written a ton of stuff in depth. They've got hands-on photos, first impressions, all sorts of stuff. If you're excited by any of this, go to wired.co.uk, search for Nokia. You'll find all of those things about the tablet and the new Lumia phones and everything by doing so. Lasers, Nicholas.
Yep. Back to the... No, I don't think I've done lasers before. I've done pretty much everything else in space.
Carry on.
I'm just so excited about the lasers.
It's fine. I don't need my intro. Carry on. I'll drink this tea.
So this is NASA's new Lunar Laser Communication Demonstration, or LLCD.
I prefer to pronounce it ILGT.
ILGT. Okay, we'll go with ILGT. And it made history by using pulsed lasers to transmit data 239,000 miles away at 622 megabits per second. Now, to just give this some kind of perspective, the famous Earthrise photo taken in 1968 by Apollo 8 took days to send and to receive, because we, back then and actually up until now, we've been using radio frequency.
I was going to say, that was 40 years ago. I mean, the most powerful computer in the world in 1968 is utterly destroyed power-wise by the phone in my pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. But funnily enough, we're still using the same communication systems, which is radio waves. And obviously, that won't do anymore. So this is why they decided to try and use laser comms, as I think they're calling them. Okay, what used to take days can now be done in a matter of seconds and 100 times over.
So per second.
Yeah, per second. So that gives you an idea of how powerful this is. And the way it works is the LLCD, or LUKT, hitches a ride on top of NASA's Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, or the LADEE. And then once it's in orbit, it transmits hundreds of millions of laser pulses using a small, lightweight telescope, which then sort of... There are three stations on Earth that then pick up this laser, and they're located in areas on Earth where there's not much cloud coverage.
Right, it's really kind of like what they do with telescopes, actually. Like, they put them on the highest points of parts of Earth. Yeah.
The really interesting thing is they don't know where the laser is in space. So the ground terminals sort of shoot lasers in the general direction of the laser they have in space, and then when they hit it, the one in space then fires down at the ground terminals until they're sort of in sync, and then they lock on, and then they can start transmitting data.
I'm with you. Now, I have to ask, though, because what's this going to be used for? Because photos, they're not that high bandwidth. I mean, they send out massive megapixels for a lot of the photos they take, but there's nothing... We're not really taking that many photos on the moon right now, which is basically how far away from Earth this is.
Yeah.
This can work. I mean, I'm guessing is like a relay thing, maybe? So once you start doing stuff from Mars, it can bounce off the one on the moon, and it just generally increases bandwidth.
Possibly. I think they're certainly looking to use this in deep space. But at the moment, they are hoping to get a number of extra pictures of the moon, and to take video as well, and 3D video, which we've not even done before.
Now that is a brilliant idea, actually. Yeah. That's a fab idea. Imagine being able to just log into like a webcam that's just sat on the moon and watch the Earth rise. Yeah, I'm all for that now.
Absolutely.
I was thinking this was really pointless because I couldn't think of a single reason, but it benefits stuff because we do this stuff all the time. But yeah, that's a brilliant idea. Oh, I'm excited now.
Yeah, I mean... I think it's the 3D video is what's most exciting to me. I think that sounds amazing. And 3D videos of the moon coming back within seconds would be great to watch.
Awesome. Well, in swallowing news, Soylent. Have you heard of Soylent?
I have.
Not the food made out of human flesh in that film.
I've heard of both,
yeah.
and I have very strong opinions about this, and conflicting as well.
Ah, okay, well, this Soylent, for the unaware, is a sort of type... Think of the world's poshest nutritional drink that's basically being created to replace the need to eat meals, fills you up, has exactly the amount of nutrients that the body needs throughout the day, can be customized for body types, for health conditions, for particular physical goals, perhaps, that you're trying to reach. And the idea is that it is a kind of no-nonsense, cheap, affordable, but nutritious alternative to food for the busy man or woman on the go, I would say. Now, I'm personally fascinated by this because, without going into great detail, I do find eating in the day kind of gets in the way of a lot of stuff, and I would be far more productive if I didn't have to go out and get food and eat it. I don't really take a great deal of pleasure from doing that. Going out for evening meals with friends is far more about the social and talking to people I like, as opposed to necessarily just the food. So I'm really excited about this. But the news is that this project that's been going on now for, I think, 2 or 3 years, possibly, by a group in the US, private individuals working on this, have just raised $1 million, so just over £600,000 in funding to get this through. And it's already been looked at favorably by a lot of scientists and nutritionists and people who, you know, basically know what they're talking about, who seem really intrigued by this. And a lot of medical people are very interested in following up what's happening with this. And now they've just got a huge amount of funding from some Silicon Valley investors to really keep this going, to push, I think, probably medical trials and development and, I suppose, marketing and what have you else down the line. But we just wanted to touch on it quite quickly because it's something, if you're not aware of, it's worth knowing about. And if you are aware of it, it's quite an interesting development because this sort of stuff takes a lot of money, and now they've got quite a lot of money.
I think what's really interesting, I'm approaching this from two different angles. when I first heard about it, I thought, this is amazing. This is excellent. This is just what I need. I'm not a big eater. I don't even get that much pleasure from food. So I thought, this is great. Mm. I can just take a drink and then I've had my lunch and then I can go off. I don't see food as this sacred moment of peace and calm.
It's that classic meal in pill form alternative.
And I love things like that. I absolutely love them. But then I thought, this guy isn't a nutritionist. Am I going to die if I suddenly, my stomach is no longer processing solids and it's just, that sounds really scary to me and it sounds like something horrible could potentially happen, and I'm a little worried by the lack of tests. I think the longest anyone's been on it is a couple of months, and to me that's not long enough if you're about to mass market the product.
Not long enough, but this is where it gets really quite interesting. Is, you know, we talk about this as like, this is all you're going to have forever and ever. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. Perhaps this could be the type of food that you actually do only have for a couple of months while going through, treatment for something, or you're out in the middle of nowhere where cooking meals isn't realistic, but actually this is a great alternative to that that's convenient for use on probably not spaceships, but, you know, like long periods of extended travel, like all these sorts of things. This is the kind of thing that could benefit.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that, you know, there are a lot of concerns, and certainly this money, I imagine, is going to some length to try and figure out whether those concerns are legitimate, and if they are, then adjust the formula and what have you. But as a project, I think this is just brilliant. I love the idea of having one Soylent meal a day.
Yeah.
And not, you know, instead of having breakfast and lunch, just be able to have this gives me an extra hour, even if it's just an hour of downtime or an hour of reading. Like, that all makes you more, can make you more productive, rather than me having to go out and queue up and get food and prepare the food, because I don't take any pleasure in that. I know a lot of people listening will probably think, are you mad? Like, love food, great, different types of food, and that's great, but that, it's irrelevant for me.
Me too.
It's a complete waste of my time.
Absolutely.
As far as I'm concerned,
couldn't agree more.
Not bothered. My brother is complete opposite. I mean, he'll spend 3 hours in a kitchen cooking dinner just to eat dinner, and I'm far more of a person who's just like, you know what, just tip onto tray, insert into oven sort of chef. So I know there'd be a lot of disagreement out there. And incidentally, podcast@wired.co.uk, let us know if you're interested in Soylent. Do you think I'm a moron for being excited about this and for not being excited generally about food? But either way, I think a really interesting development, regardless of whether it's the future of swallowing, as I've said in the past.
Yeah, and
or not.
The future of bowel movements as well, because goodness knows what those are going to be like.
Yeah, podcast@wired.co.uk. Noise pollution. Some would consider us polluting with noise if turned up too loud.
Nonsense.
Absolutely. You. But it's something that has been, that you've been writing about this week, crowdsourced noise pollution.
Yeah. So the main cause of noise pollution tends to be machines, transportation, poor urban planning, people. And the problem with this is that it can sort of vary quite considerably. And so the consequently difficult and expensive to monitor, and the results are often inaccurate. So a group of researchers were thinking about this. They're from the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, or CSIRO, in Australia. It's a new one. They've created this device called Earphone, which is an inexpensive crowdsourced alternative to collecting noise data. So they realize that the average smartphone has enough sophisticated technology on board, like microphones, GPS, time stamping, etc., to make it an extraordinary mobile monitoring device. So they thought, if we can just have this sort of always on and always collecting data, then we can use that to map out where various noises are coming from, how loud they are, etc.
I have to ask, because actually I don't know much about this story, to be perfectly honest with you, but I'm curious what people do with this data. Like, when you know there's a lot of noise happening, I mean, what use is that?
They actually didn't say, but I one can only imagine. I mean, if it's very... If there's an awful lot of traffic somewhere, maybe you need more traffic lights, or perhaps there needs to be something to slow that congestion down. Or
I thought you meant things like the fact that there's someone's been building an extension to their house behind my house for what now feels like about 3 months. And I'm not kidding. They were out the other day hammering and sawing at 8 a.m. Now, that to me is noise pollution, but I wasn't about to pull out my phone and double check on screen whether, in fact, my noise is being polluted. What I actually wanted to do was open the window window and throw the phone at them with a rude word on the screen.
Well, you could display, if this thing was in action, you could display this map to them and say, now look, you've gone into the red, because it's all color coded. So if it's very loud, it will be red, for example, and it's very quiet, it would be blue. You say, you've gone into the red, this is unacceptable. You're being as noisy as a pneumatic drill. Stop it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can just imagine sort of walking up to a group of very busy, probably quite exhausted builders and saying, now look, I've got some evidence and data on my device here that says that you're being too loud. You know, you see this little red bar? That means you're too loud. Can you be a little... You need to get into the yellow at least, please. Thank you. Now, I can imagine that conversation. I can imagine the looks on their faces. Okay, interesting. And is there a benefit? Should we care? Is there even a reason to care? I mean, we must be if we're talking about it.
Well, now look, there's lots of reasons. It can cause excessive noise, can cause high blood pressure, stress, sleeplessness, but it's more less damaging to humans, I would say, although I guess if all of those accumulate, it got really bad, you could probably die. But it's the wildlife that's more concerning, because it reduces livable habitats, it disrupts predator or prey detection and avoidance, and interestingly it also causes infidelity in finches.
Specifically finches?
It's just specifically actually zebra finches. They just decide to go off and have an awful lot of sex when it gets loud.
Doesn't that happen with humans?
I don't know. Maybe I should try it. Maybe I should go around shouting and see if more people will just
start getting,
commit adultery and
yeah.
and have sex with me.
It was quite funny. I have to say, though, with all the building going on behind my house, in a single moment, I wanted to slam on some Barry White. Well, we're going to fly into an ad break now. And when we come back, we're going to talk all about the new Apple products. But specifically, because by the time you listen to this, you've probably heard of it already. But specifically, we're going to talk about what they're actually like, because I went over to the launch event and actually used them. So all that coming up. Oh, you know what time it is, listeners. It's time to get a free audiobook. And of course, you still want one. Audible.co.uk is still offering you, listening to this, a free audiobook. And if you haven't tried it before now, then I have no idea why not, because you've got a catalogue of 80,000 titles to choose from, and get one of those for free for being a listener to this podcast. Now, a 1 month free trial costs no pounds and no pence if you head to audible.co.uk/wired. Sign up in a few clicks, pick a book, download it for no money, and listen to it. The fact is, you'll get a free book, you'll be supporting our show, and you'll get to try Audible. There is quite literally no bad reason. So do it now, you'll be supporting us. audible.co.uk/wired. Welcome back. It's time to get our pads on, our eyes on. And in fact, I got my eyes on new pads this week.
Really?
Yes, because it's time to ride the Technosaurus. Just climbing off the old Technosaurus there. Thank you for that. Yes, so I went to the Apple launch that took place this week, where the company announced quite a broad number of refreshes and launches to its portfolio. And we're going to race through a few of these just to remind the people that haven't seen the news on basically every tech site everywhere already. New OS X version came out. It's called Mavericks. It's going to be free to everyone as far back as Snow Leopard, which I believe was sort of shipped on machines in about 2007, 2008. So basically any Mac you've got since that period is entitled to a free upgrade to Mavericks. So that's out now. There's iWork, which is Apple's alternative to Microsoft Office, is now completely rebuilt and also free for people who've already owned a previous copy, or with every new Mac that comes free as standard, as well as the iOS versions, which are also redesigned and also free with new iOS devices and as a free upgrade. There's new MacBook Pros. They kind of look the same. There's not a huge amount changed, except the processors are faster, the graphics are better, the battery life is improved, and some of the flash storage available on the inside has been increased as well. So that's really quite interesting. There's a new Mac Pro. This is Apple's really high-end desktop machine for creative professionals and filmmakers and stuff like that. And this thing's powerful enough to basically render 4K video in real time on three 4K screens simultaneously, so it's a bit intense in terms of most people's needs and uses, but that's going to be out in December, and it kind of looks like a spaceship. And the iPad line was refreshed, and that's the thing that I wanted to talk about specifically today, because the iPads, I think, have been changed the most significantly. Firstly, Nicholas, you've seen the news, you've read my piece. Do you think there's a reason to be excited about what I'm about to say?
I think there is, particularly with the iPad Mini.
Okay, well, we can start with the iPad Mini,
sure,
if you wish. It wasn't in the order on our running order here, but that's fine. We can we do stuff on the fly here sometimes. We're going to rotate these things. Yes, the iPad Mini was completely overhauled. It actually looks exactly the same, as long as the device is off. But the big difference is that it now has a Retina display. So it has the same resolution as the full-size iPad, which we'll talk about shortly, but it's been squozened 2 inches smaller, which means you get this resolution that is higher than the resolution of a video on Blu-ray, 1920 by 1080. It's higher than that, but it's been crammed into about 8 inches, so the pixels are much smaller, there's more of them, and they're tighter together, so it is an insanely crisp screen. It's also got the A7 processor that was introduced with the iPhone 5S.
I was going to say, does that mean this is as powerful as an iPhone 5S?
It certainly does. And here's the interesting thing, is that we're going to come, as I said, we're going to come to the other, the full-size iPad, which has also got this chip. And the A7 chip in the full-size iPad is twice as fast as the previous model 10-inch iPad, which was already insanely fast, that had the A6X chip in it. Yeah. So it's twice as powerful as that. But that means that within the iPad Mini, the actual speed increase versus the previous model is the same as going from an iPad 2, just the second iPad that was ever made, right up to the brand new, just introduced 10-inch iPad. Because the existing iPad Mini was just an iPad 2 with a smaller screen. The tech inside is literally the same. So that's the kind of jump in performance you're talking, plus the screen resolution and the graphics and everything. They've also released a 128 gig version as well, which I'm really excited about. So this is a really exciting product. The only real disappointment is that the price, I think, might is a little bit more expensive, which is a bit of a shame, but they are keeping the older version on sale as well as the iPad 2. That's still selling. That thing just won't die. And the camera hasn't been improved, which is a little bit of a shame. But it's also got this sort of, what do they call it? The M7 motion coprocessor thingy that was also introduced in the iPhone 5. So that's the thing that kind of knows if you're walking or if you're in a car. So if you pull up maps and you get direct, if it detects you're driving because of the difference in movement, it'll show you driving directions. If it detects that you're walking, it'll show you on foot directions instead. So those sort of little perks and benefits and stuff are also now in the iPad Mini. So I'm really excited about this. I love the iPad Mini. In fact, we both must do, because we're both standing here reading our notes off iPad Minis. So this is really exciting, I think. That's going to be out at the end of November. But it is still a lot more expensive than things like the Nexus 7, you know, which is an incredibly powerful, very, very popular Android device. So it's still very much a premium, I don't say premium, that makes it sound like the Nexus isn't. The Nexus is a premium product. It's just that the price you're paying now for Apple's iPad Mini is a lot more than what's out there. But if you're in the Apple world and want to stay there, then there's a lot to be excited about, I think.
And definitely an upgrade to make, even if you've just got an iPad Mini, because
the upgrade, the difference between those two models is
huge.
Astounding. I was using them side by side. Bonkers how much faster and better looking that new one is. So,
and I think particularly now with iOS 7, because you have all the multitasking, so you can, you know, I do notice things slowing down when I'm flicking through different pages. I've got several different things open and I'm trying to get to things quickly.
Yeah.
I probably will upgrade.
Yeah, without question. It's that's going to be tremendous. So the other thing is the 10-inch iPad. Now, this has the biggest physical change aside from the screen. They've renamed it to the iPad Air, which is a side note, and I didn't put this in my hands on. I actually think I probably should have done. I'm really interested in this because I reckon they're going to bring out another iPad, 12 inches, called the iPad Pro.
Right. I was going to ask. I didn't understand the name change at all.
I think that's why.
Yeah.
I think in maybe not this year, but I think possibly next year, maybe in spring or something, I think they might bring out a bigger iPad with a higher resolution screen.
And do you think there'll be any other features that we haven't seen in an iPad before?
Yes, almost certainly. Frankly, I haven't even thought that far ahead. I've just been thinking from a product naming strategy. Yeah. But Sharp, I was reading this morning, actually. Sorry, I'm completely off notes here. But Sharp's got this new display that's like a 4K display that fits in, I think, like a 10 or 12-inch panel. 4K resolution. Right. So that's way higher even than the iPad's current display. So you're talking crazy resolution. So I do wonder, and Sharp has provided make screens for iPads. So I do sort of wonder if those sorts of bits of things are coming together. That's a little bit of guesswork going on there, but it wouldn't surprise me. But the new model is also physically, it's about 30% lighter. It's about 20%, I think, thinner. and the bezel around the screen is much smaller, so you don't feel like you're holding this giant slab of metal, but actually the screen is sort of much smaller than the device you're holding. It feels so different. It just feels like you're holding a slightly bigger iPad mini,
yeah,
as opposed to something that you could, you know, kill a whale with. It's so big and chunky.
Yeah,
I held it reasonably comfortably in one hand when I was doing a thing, which you just can't do with the previous iPad.
No, you really
iPad.
Can't. That's been one of the things that has put me off, you know, getting the full-size iPad, is the weight, and it just feels cumbersome.
Yeah.
So I'd be really keen to get my hands on the iPad Air.
Yeah, well, we're going to have Stefan, when it comes out, it's going to be coming out, that one is going to come out the 1st of November. And if you're intrigued, do go, find an Apple store, whether you want to buy one or not. It's really fun. Go and have a look at the difference of the new one and have a feel of it. It's quite profound, quite profoundly improved.
Did we talk about the new chip in the iPad Air?
Yeah, well, the iPad Air's got the A7, so that's the same as the iPad Mini. In fact, that's the other interesting thing, actually. The iPad Mini and the iPad Air are now basically the same product. The only thing it comes down to at this point is screen size. Like, yes, the iPad Air has a slightly better camera now. It's a bit improved. It's nowhere near as good as the iPhones. It's a little bit better than the previous model. But that's almost the only difference. The chip's the same. The memory's the same. The OS is the same. The screen resolution's the same. And in fact, because the iPad Mini's got a smaller screen, the resolution's actually tighter on the Mini.
Yeah.
So effectively, you could argue that the screen on the Mini is probably better. So the difference comes down to size and price.
The one thing that is really annoying me with tablets lately is the cameras. They're all locked at 5 megapixels. I've not seen a tablet with a camera with any greater quality than that.
Actually, you know what? We didn't mention this earlier, but the Lumia tablet camera is really good. They've given it Carl Zeiss optics.
Oh, right.
And it's got a f1.9 aperture, I think, which is really wide. So it'd be really good in low light. So actually, Nokia is doing on tablets sort of kind of what it's also trying to do on phones.
Yeah.
So that's actually probably going to be a really good tablet if you do want to be one of those people that holds up a 10-inch device to take a picture. And if you are, please don't do that when you're at the front at a gig, because you are the most annoying person in that room. Without question, go to the back. But I agree with you. It's a shame. But I think it's really just an acceptance that people are taking pictures with tablets, but they're not trying to take photography with these things. And a lot of them are basically being Instagram filtered anyway. So, you know, they end up looking like they've been dragged through the 70s. So
yeah, yeah.
They didn't have those sorts of cameras in the 70s.
Yeah.
So who cares?
And interestingly, with Nokia again, fantastic hardware. You know, if they are doing the best.
Well, according to Wired's Katie Collins,
yeah,
great hardware.
Yeah,
but I trust her.
We've not touched them yet. No, we haven't.
Well, anyway, that's going to do it. Let us know what you think. Are you going to be upgrading to Mavericks? Have you done it already? Are you happy? You're listening. Why you're not firing up an email right now to give us your opinions? You know, type them with your fists if you want. If you're that passionate, just do that. podcast@wired.co.uk. We'll read some out next week. Last story today, and this is part of the segment WWWTF. Bit more serious, I think, than perhaps the previous story. Well, it is more serious than the previous story. There was a lot of controversy surrounding Facebook this week, Nicholas, that blew up very quickly and was U-turned on very quickly.
Yeah.
What's been going on this week? So I think it's important that everyone knows about what's been happening.
Absolutely. I'll try and break it down because it's kind of a mess. So Facebook lifted a ban on extreme and graphic content despite taking down graphic content of a similar kind in May 2013. And they lifted this ban, and there's a new video that appeared where a man is seen decapitating a woman in Mexico, which is not very nice. The video obviously received a hell of a lot of complaints, both from regular users and public figures. Even David Cameron tweeted that it was irresponsible for Facebook to be doing this. Then Wired got in touch. It was actually Liat. She called up Facebook and said, look, is this video going to stay? Because it's obviously disgusting. And they said that we're going to put a warning up, but the video will remain. Which is kind of weird, because it's obviously something that shouldn't be watched by 13-year-olds, which is the minimum age requirement for Facebook. So if you look at their terms and conditions, Facebook says that their site is a place to share experiences, particularly when they're connected to controversial events on the ground, such as human rights abuses, acts of terrorism, and other violent events. As such, people sharing videos of these events on Facebook to condemn them are perfectly acceptable, basically. So as long as you're condemning the awful thing that's going on in the video, you're allowed to host it on Facebook, apparently.
But a really common complaint that's been used quite a lot around this sort of topic is the fact that, you know, there are forums of, you know, like sort of new mothers talking about breastfeeding and things like that, and tips and things, and photos, basically, according to Facebook's terms and conditions and what they've done this week, that a photo of a breast, just of a woman's breast, is not acceptable, but a photo of a woman being beheaded is.
Yeah, and this
now,
is
that is
absurd.
A very dangerous double standard.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's there are all sorts of weird things that come about from this sort of censorship. I mean, there was a guy once that, when they had similar rules on YouTube that has since been revised, but a while ago there was a guy who posted a naked breast, a part of his art project, on YouTube, and they took it down, and then he thought, okay, well, which bit's the problem? And they said, oh, the nipple. So he covered up the nipple, but with a Photoshop version of his own nipple, which he had shaved and put onto the woman's breast.
Wow.
So it still looked like a breast, and they still took it down. So you can get into these very weird situations with censorship like this, where it doesn't really make any sense, and you can get some odd double standards, and the things that they specify as being the objective element of the video tend to be very loose and difficult to pin down, which is exactly what happened with Facebook. So they said, well, the person that uploaded the video is condemning the video, but it's still a horrible video that no one should really encounter, and it's
absolutely
psychologically damaging.
And what can make this so much more of a problem for something like Facebook is, you know, they've got well over a billion users, obviously got a lot of kids from 13 and up. And to be honest, I think even when it comes down to age, I mean, yes, obviously this sort of video can be very damaging on a young mind, but to be perfectly honest, it can be very damaging on someone who's 30 or someone who's 50.
Well, yeah.
You know, I mean, the age thing almost goes out the window at this point, because really it shouldn't be for any age to see this, particularly without seeking it out or knowing what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah.
And the other problem with Facebook is that, you know, for example, if we were friends on Facebook and I post a link to that video or post that video and I write something on as a comment. No, in fact, if someone else has posted that video and I go on and comment on that video and say, I can't believe this is allowed, I can't believe this is on Facebook, this is terrible, da, 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 your newsfeed might pop up and say, you know, Nate Langston comments on XYZ video with that comment. And you might think, oh, what's Nate so up in arms about? I mean, friends on Facebook, you're interested in what your friends are doing, you might click it, see that video. So that sort of viral, the thing that's inherent to the reason why Facebook is so useful to people from a social angle and for spreading information can sort of mask sometimes things that maybe you're about to see, because if you just see that someone's commented and not the video in question, like, it can be very, very difficult. And yeah, that's another reason why I think this is more important on Facebook even than possibly even for some sites like YouTube and things that I don't want to say specialize in flagging this content up, but that sort of material is still permitted on YouTube for a lot of types of this sort of content, but it's very well flagged.
Yeah.
Community flags and teams of people that make sure that this stuff is flagged, is filtered. You know, this is very different, I
and
think.
That's exactly the point with this stuff as well. I think that, you know, I don't want there to be huge amounts of censorship at all. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying this thing, these sorts of videos have a place on the internet, and I think they should be around, because I think people should know how disgusting humans can be, but I don't think Facebook is where it belongs.
No.
It's entirely where inappropriate.
It's certainly where the discussion belongs, perhaps, but not the actual the content itself. I agree.
Completely.
And I think as well, I mean, I don't play devil's advocate in a way, really, but one of the problems that I think Facebook has, which I really don't envy, is that at the end of the day, it's an American company based in America, but it has a billion users around the world, and it has, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of users in countries, you know, where views on things that are morally acceptable or politically acceptable or are deemed inappropriate or not differ hugely. And
yeah,
in America, obviously, you know, big emphasis on free speech and freedom of expression and things like that. That is not the case in a lot of countries. Similarly, there are, you know, graphic videos of all sorts of things shown on regular news channels in other parts of the world that you would never see on the equivalent program in Britain.
Yeah.
So Facebook's in this position where it has to balance all of this type of stuff, censorship, freedom, all this stuff for a global audience, because that's basically what we're dealing with now.
Yeah.
And controversies sometimes, I think, arise because Facebook has to pick where the balance should be for the world, And that's not always the right decision. And Facebook also has a tendency to basically screw up first and apologize later.
Yeah. But how troubling as well that Facebook assumes that the world's moral compass is pointing towards beheading videos being all right. I find that a bit worrying. I don't think that's okay. Interestingly, Facebook then did change its mind the day after and said, oh, actually, that does breach our terms and conditions, and we're going to take it down.
Yeah, it's like, no shizzle, Sherlock. Yeah. But and I agree with you, and I do agree that there is a place, that, you know, the internet is, these videos do exist for a reason, and there is a reason for them to be seen. However, exactly as you were saying, a social network is not necessarily the correct platform for such material to be viewed so easily and with such little motivation to see or discover that. Mm. There are very different websites that exist for that. In the same way that Facebook isn't the same place, let's say, for gambling necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, it's there are certain things that possibly don't belong in certain situations. And there's no right or wrong way. There'll be people listening, I'm sure, now who agree completely with everything we've said. There'll be people that don't agree. And that's kind of, that underscores the inherent issue underlying all of this stuff, is that everyone has a different view on what's right and what's wrong. And everyone's view on freedom of expression and freedom of access and, you know, the general sort of democratization of access to material that highlights things that happen in the world is just at such a... The access is just so huge that there comes a point you have to draw a line, and that line is higher or lower for various different people, and it's a real challenge. Mm. Well, as ever, let us know your thoughts, whether you agree with what Facebook did or not, or any of our opinions, obviously, today. podcast@wired.co.uk or, hell, facebook.com/wiredUK, which, by the way, just might point out, a total safe haven as far as graphic violence is concerned. We do sometimes post a lot of videos of insects being decapitated and having electrodes put in their brain, or, you know, having artificial limbs created on monkeys. However, we have a very strict rule about not posting graphically violent human acts on our Facebook page. So it's always a safe haven.
Absolutely. Just harmless fun.
Next week, where we'll also hear from Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, because I interviewed him on stage at a conference this week, and we're going to be pick some select portions from that to play on next week's program, because made quite a lot of headlines that morning. Yeah. It's all over the place. It was quite nice, actually. So we're gonna hear some choice moments from that next week, as well as your feedback. Liat and Liv will be back next week, and in the meantime, don't forget, you can get in touch, podcast@wired.co.uk, facebook.com/WiredUK. Here's a new one. google.com/+WiredUK. They really need to sort those bloody URLs out.
Yeah.
But we do have a massive and growing Google Plus community now that's sort of pushing about 100,000 people. So do head on over there and join in some discussions and things. And we will see you next week.
Ta-ra.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.